Everybody, this is William Del Pilar, and this is Red, White, and Rude. And guys, just a second ago, I was ready to talk in Spanish. I don't know what the heck happened with my wires there. Anyway, I hope everybody had a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And to my non-Christian friends, Happy Holidays. What is it, Kwanzaa? Hanukkah, I don't know. They're either what I mean, but happy holidays to everybody. I want to be inclusive. I am not a mean, vile person. Anyway, we've got a great show for everybody tonight as we enter this new year. We've been off the air since before Christmas, and we're going to talk about some comedy and we're going to go old school. And by old school, I mean two old farts, myself and Big John T. Georgopoulos, who is a comedy legend in his mind, but he's like an encyclopedia when it comes to all things comedy. We are going to talk Anthony Jeselnik. We're going to talk his views of cancel culture, his relationships in the comedic world. And if you've never heard of Anthony Jeselnik, that's okay. I never did neither until I ran across him on Netflix. It's such, and Jeselnik has said this in interviews, we are living in the golden era of comedy because more comedians are making more money than ever before because of the internet, because of their ability to transcend the comedy clubs, hoping to make it to theaters. Now it's much easier with the online ability to showcase their work, as well as being a tight circuit of friends. Joe Rogan has helped a lot of comedians, so there's those kind of circuits, and that's only one I can think of. A Big John will tell us about more. But real quick, Anthony Jeselnik is a comedian known for his dark humor and biting wit. He's the type of guy that will make baby jokes, pedophile jokes, jokes that people cringe at, and he mocks that too. He says, okay, you may cringe on this one, you know? So, I mean, he's self-aware and he's what I call a true talent. I can't explain it, but sometimes you see people and you're like, dude, that's a master at work. And that's what you get when you watch Anthony Jeselnik. And he's done very well for himself. Turns out he started out, well, he got his break with doing Central Comedy Roast. And that's an art unto itself. Tony Hinchcliffe is a comedian that I am laughing every minute of the day when he's doing a roast. When he's not doing a roast and doing his podcast, which is uber popular, I'm waiting to laugh. So to each their own, and each has their own specialty. So Jeselnik's unique brand of dark humor is what sets him apart. He's the only one that I've seen in my 50 some odd years that does it like he does. His rise of fame was slow but steady. He's created controversy recently, which is why we're going to talk about him. He's criticized Joe Rogan, who I don't think is funny at all. But Joe Rogan has made it himself in that world. He's criticized Rogan and his circle. I kind of see it as a strategic move by him because he himself has said in podcasts that, hey, having an adversary, having somebody you're fighting with, it's good for business. So maybe he's creating that rivalry himself for that one reason. Some might view this as cynical. His approach does align with that belief. He's targeting Joe Rogan, one of the biggest names in the comedic world, and we'll get Big John's take on that. But his journey does highlight the complexities, and we're going to talk about it, of gaining recognition in a fragmented media landscape. And by fragmented, Big John and myself, we're on completely different spectrums on what we think is funny. And I was just telling them off camera, hey, I've come to respect the fact that that dude sucks. He's not funny, but I respect the fact that he's a comedian and has made it because he's selling out theaters. He's selling out he has Netflix specials. He's well known. I mean, you can be successful and you may not be liked by many, but to each whatever the saying is. My point is that if you like him, that's okay. If I don't like him, that's okay too. It's a big market out there with many different tastes. And with that, let us bring Big John. Big John, you can tell when I don't rehearse or practice up an intro,
Yeah,
huh?
yeah, yeah. I always find it funny because when you get flustered, you could tell sometimes that English may not have been your first language. Like instead of Comedy Central, you said Central Comedy.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. That is a language thing. That is exactly right. That's a language issue. All right, let's talk to Anthony Jeselnik. When I say Anthony Jeselnik, give me your brief thoughts on him before we get to do a deep dive.
You know, he's an interesting guy. I don't know how much of that is an act and how much of it is his personality, and that he just turns up his personality for his act. You know, William, if you're a pro wrestling fan, they always tell you the best pro wrestlers are the ones who are portraying themselves, but with the volume turned up to 10, right? So Ric Flair really lives like that. He really loves having thousands of bitches at his beck and call. He loves drinking all night. He can, you know, like what his character in the ring is just an exaggeration of his actual persona. And that's what makes him a great wrestler.
Stop. Before you go on, you got to give me the Ric Flair. Woo. Come on.
Woo. No, there you go. Woo.
Woo.
Woo. Yeah, the old chest slaps and the. If I had a razor blade, I'd open up my forehead on principle just to give him homage.
And we're digressing here, though. But see, Ric Flair is who I grew up watching wrestling because he was part of the NWA North Carolina. When did you first discover him? WWF?
No, no. I had known about him because I was heavy into pro wrestling. So I used to read all about him when he was in the Carolinas, when he was in Minnesota. He was all over the place. He was in Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Flair. Who was his first hardcore partner?
Oh, he used to be partners with Greg the Hammer Valentine. Greg, he used to be, yeah, yeah,
Valentine.
Yeah, my personal favorite wrestler of all time, Greg Valentine. But yeah, so the thing that made Ric Flair great was it was his personality, but just super amplified. And I'm wondering if Jezelnik is that way. So I'll tell you who he reminds me of.
Let me feed you here. Jezelnik is a self-professed loner. He doesn't need people, doesn't care about people. So I would agree with you that, or I would take it one step further and say, you're right in with that train of thought. He is not that persona, but there's aspects of him that is that persona.
Yeah, yeah. So like I said, I'm not saying he's that miserable in his personal life. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But I'm saying it could be that he's a curmudgeon. Look, when I say that, I don't mean that negatively. I consider myself a curmudgeon around a lot of things. You're just like miserable to be around. You're a misanthrope for the most part. You don't like being around other people. Other people, no matter how well-intentioned, always seem to annoy you. And for years, like when I was on Sirius XM radio, when I had my own show, my character that I portrayed on the radio was a curmudgeon. It was just like somebody who was always miserable, somebody who could never find anything good at anything, right? And that's part of a comedic thing. It's meant to portray sarcasm and satire to some extent. So you have Jezelnik that's like that. And I was going to say, he reminds me a lot, and I don't know if it's an inspiration of his, but I could see him picturing like this being this generation's Steve Landisberg.
Steve, tell us who he is.
Sure. Steve Landisberg, like if you're old enough to remember Steve Landisberg at all, you probably remember him playing the role of Sergeant Dietrich on the old Barney Miller sitcoms, which was early to mid 80s, I would say. Now that for a lot of our younger viewers, they'll have to go on YouTube. But Steve Landisberg in his stand-up routine, which they then transferred because he was such a popular stand-up comic at the time, they took his stand-up character, just like Ray Romano. That's him. There you go. Beautiful. Good job, William. Ray Romano, what you saw in Everybody Loves Raymond was his stand-up act. And they took his stand-up act and they made it into a sitcom. Same thing with Bill Cosby. They took a lot of the material from his album himself and they turned that into The Cosby Show. Landisberg was this type of character during his stand-up, and they said this guy would fit in well as a quirky detective on Barney Miller, and that's what they did. And he was like the atheist, which even in the early 80s was considered slightly shocking if you admitted you were an atheist,
right?
And he was the logical guy, where everybody else around him was emotional. He was always the logical, sarcastic guy. Now, his delivery was always misdirection. You know, he had a deep voice and it was very slow and measured. You know, he'd be like, so, you know, hey, Wojo, you know,
All right, John, I apologize. I'm going to keep pausing just for the audience. What John means by misdirection, he's correct. Jeselnik, he leads his audiences.
Yeah.
Misdirection is when you expect one punchline before delivering an unexpected twist. And that's why that's what he does with the baby jokes, the pedophilia jokes, the I love mom jokes. The fact, that's what, you're expecting this typical comedy, and he goes another avenue.
Right, and by the way, misdirection is a valued comedic trick, right? It's not anything that's new that Jeselnik came up with. Misdirection, let me give you one of his jokes. I think it was from his Thoughts and Prayers stand-up special on Netflix, right? He said, I live next door to a 96-year-old Alzheimer's patient in L.A., and every morning this man wakes me up at 6 a.m., and I get to my door at 6 a.m., and every morning I have to tell this poor, sweet old 96-year-old man that his wife has been dead for decades and that he'll never see her again. Now, I know a lot of you would think this is annoying, but I do it just for the smile I see on his face every time he asks me, right? So the misdirection was that he's annoyed at this guy waking him up at 6 a.m., but he enjoys it because he gets to remind this guy how much he hated his wife and that she's been dead for decades, right? That's misdirection because he's leading you down one path and then complete 180, right? So that is the thing. Now, Jeselnik also throws in a very dark side to it, like you said, right? So whereas Landisberg, his misdirection was like, you know, sort of like also what Mitch Hedberg would do and some of these other comedians that had that same style. They would say something like, why do they call it jumbo shrimp? You know, because that's oxymoronic. Or why do you park in the driveway and drive on the parkway? Like, that's not quite misdirection, but like some female comics were very good at it too, where they would take you down this thing where they were giving you like something like, oh, a lovely lady would say this. And then they turn and say something completely out of line
you just touched on something there too. He does taboo topics or subjects. It's a moral or psychopathic persona he portrays. And he's done burn victim jokes. That was a brutal one. When he came, it was a misdirection. And then the burn victim, you're like, oh, shit. You know? And he's done rape jokes, pedophilia jokes.
Murder-suicide jokes.
Yeah. Baby jokes. And he mocks his last special. He's had two specials over the last couple of years. And one of them, he actually does ask the audience, you're really wondering if you should be laughing by this point, shouldn't you? Or should you be concerned, you know?
He
kind of does a fourth wall type thing, kind of like I'm breaking from my routine and telling you this is how you should be feeling. But it kind of humanizes him in the sense, okay, he's not. Because when I was listening to him for the first time, I'm saying, babe, you know, you can't be doing this stuff and not have some odd. And then he comes out and says that. And it kind of makes you feel like, okay, maybe he's not as psychopathic.
Right. And I think psychopathic is a good description because for you to deliver that successfully and be funny, part of the delivery has to be that you're detached, that you have no emotion for this, right? So even when he pretends that he's angry at something that he's talking about to set up his misdirection, the punchline takes away the emotion of it. Do you know what I mean? And it kind of like portrays that. And like you said, Jeselnik, from what I could tell, and again, I don't know him personally, I've never met him, but just from the stuff you read about his interactions with some other comics, there may be a lot of truth to the fact that he is a miserable person to deal with as a, like in real life, you know, that he's not.
This is what he said, Big John. He said that, he goes, here's the truth that people don't talk about. He goes, the circle of friends, he goes, when they're successful, you never see them. They're on tour, they have families, this and that. He goes, the only comics you see on a daily basis are the ones who are up and coming. He goes, and when I'm not on tour, I'm at home, you know? Because it sounds like he goes through a burnout scenario. Well, he'll work on his stuff for a year. Then he'll he'll do the comedy clubs and theaters for a year. And start out with the comedy clubs, and I'm assuming he's still testing and holding his craft. They'll do the theaters. Then the following year, he'll go international. Then he comes and takes a year off. So it sounds like he's your true master. So, I mean, hearing that, And we're purely speculating, but it seems to me that maybe it's a little miswarranted that he's an asshole to work with as much as he's a self-professed loner. He'd rather he's okay being alone. He's in his lot in life. Because it's like when you were talking curmudgeon, I'm like, that motherfucker, he's describing me. Because I'm a loner. And I told John off camera, I got to get out of that. I purposely forced myself out of the house at times so I don't lose social skills, so I don't lose a love for humanity. Because when you're in your basement like we are, it's easy to live in your own world. So do you think maybe it's just a combination of all the above of what I just said?
No. And again, I'm just talking about what I know that's public about him. Obviously, we don't know. I don't know him intimately at all in any way, shape, or form. But like, for example, he really doesn't care what other people think of him. Like, and he doesn't mind crapping on other comics. I mean, he's gotten into beefs with Tim Dillon, pseudo beefs with Rogan. Supposedly, and again, now this one I'm not sure about, Norm MacDonald, when they were hosting co-hosting last Comic Standing, right?
Like, I can tell you about that. He idolized Norm.
No, I understand that part. Yeah,
get along.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah,
Norm broke the ice when he's like, "Hey, let's have a truce and all there. You go there and just hammer me like I suck and all this, and I'll do the same. You know, we'll create." I forget what the reason was for.
It was for a press conference for Comic Standing. Yeah.
But I don't know why Norm wanted to do that. If he wanted to create a pseudo rivalry for the show or whatnot.
Well, you're right, and it's just something comics do. It's just that they'll just crap on each other, and they'll get joy out of hammering each other. Yeah,
and that's what happened. So Anthony's like, you know, Anthony's still the lesser known, and Norm's his idol. Okay. So he goes out there. Well, Norm's an ass. You know, Norm does. Blah, blah, blah. Then Norm comes out there. Just that. That's a damn hell of a comic.
He totally swerved him. Yeah.
And then he goes, they started to get along. But he goes, they were miserable because they were out of their elements. He was a host. He couldn't crack. They weren't there for him, he realized. They're not here to hear me do my jokes. I'm a host doing this. So it sounded like he had a miserable time. It sounded like he couldn't be a comic. And then Norm, you know, just so, but they got along eventually. But I never heard of him picking fights until like this offseason. That's when I discovered it.
Well, I don't even know that he picks. I mean, without saying who's at fault at anything, he certainly, even if he doesn't initiate stuff, he doesn't seem to let anything go either. Like, it's interesting because, like, I've heard other comics in other various venues say, yeah, you know, like, okay, he's funny, but, you know, and he gets a lot of criticism from some of them, right? Because a lot of them say his act is very predictable. And if you watch one special of his, you'll laugh, no matter which one it is. I think most people would laugh. Watch the second special, and you're finishing half his jokes before he hits his punchline, if you're any good.
Well, I caught the same joke.
Yeah, or the same joke, right. The third special you see of his, you're finishing all his jokes. Because by now, because he doesn't vary his style at all, and his style is very predictable, you know that everything is a misdirection. So it's just a matter of how good is the misdirection, right? But
no, you're right, John. But let me push back just
in. Yeah, sure.
John is absolutely right. I agree with him because I did watch all three of his specials.
Yeah.
And the misdirection is his shtick. It becomes predictable. But what makes him funny still is he changes up the topics. And he talked about that. Like, he'll have done like 13-year-old kids or something. That was a part of his whole show. And then after the show, somebody will say something or he'll see something like, oh my God, it's a great joke. He's like, I won't do it. Because I did that whole shtick already. So I tried to move on to keep it fresh. But you're right. Maybe that's why he tries so hard to keep the content fresh.
Well, he has to. Yeah, he has to. Yeah. That's the only way he can extend his career. And listen, there have been other comics who have done this for 40 years that have become Vegas lounge acts, right? Like, and the whole time we've been talking, I was trying to think of the female comedian that I was trying to describe. Her name was Rita Rudner. It finally came to me at my age, right?
Rita Rudner. She's 70s now, or 80s, right? From the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, right? No, from the 80s, mid 80s to early 90s. And she was an interesting one because she started out life as a ballerina. And when you saw her on stage, you could see her being a ballerina. She's this tiny little thing, right? She had the big eyes. Yeah, she had the big eyes. Yeah. And she dealt in sort of misdirection, right? Sort of like da-da-da-da-da-da. That was her cadence, right? Da-da-da-da-da-da. And if you listen to Jeselnik, his rhythm is always the same. It's the same cadence, right? I did this, I hate this, and you know this, blah, then the misdirection, right?
Right.
In some ways, he might be derivative of Dave Attell, although Dave Attell, I think, is much more varied, and he's more, I just think he's funnier. He's the godfather of a certain genre of comedy. And when you listen to people with a certain cadence, they all got it from Dave Attell, right? So,
right.
Now, like I said, the one that I think reminds me the most of, that Jeselnik reminds me the most of is Steve Landisberg. I mean, I think he passed away a couple, maybe 10, 15 years ago. But
2010.
Close enough.
I remember when he passed away. See, people, y'all may not have gone through it, but when you grew up as a kid watching shows, like Barney Miller was one of the most watched television comedies. And it was, I don't want to call it intellectual humor, but characters like Steve's was a bit intellectual. Then they had the silly characters. It was a police precinct. So you saw the simple storylines.
Abe Vigoda. People forget. Abe Vigoda. Fish.
But here's a picture of Rita.
Rudner. Rita Rudner.
Rudner. Yes. And I remember. Yeah, I remember her. Is she still around? I don't know.
But this is her at now. I mean, this is her at probably over 70 years old. If you saw her when she first started, and obviously she was much younger, she was much cuter, but she still had the big eyes and everything. And she had the one-liners that were all misdirections, you know. I can't remember any of her jokes right now. She wasn't one of my favorites, but, you know. But where she found a second life was in Las Vegas. You know, she did all the, you know, she became like a resident act in Vegas. And that's how she extended her career by a good 10, 20 years, right? Because that type of humor, once you've heard it once or twice, becomes boring.
And you know what, John? It's kind of funny because you see a lot of these people, that's her younger.
Yeah, that's her younger. Yeah.
And I'm not stereotyping, but I'm not even going to go there. But I'm looking at her look and coming out of a certain comedy circuit. But I've never found people who end up in Vegas. I'm like, God bless them. They're smart enough and business savvy enough, because that's my chance to catch. I never saw him, but I love, hey, I love you. Yada, 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 yada. So that's what David Cassidy, he was a girl thing, but I'm like, he was part of my era growing up. And I always thought it just would have been cool to have seen him. So you get that opportunity with a lot of acts like the Tiger guys. I mean, they're old now. One got attacked and beat up. I mean, they were a big phenomenon. They were always a Vegas act. But Vegas gives you that final opportunity to see a lot of these acts. You know, I saw Wayne Brady, and he's much better.
Wayne Brady, but I was going to say, Wayne Newton is the classic one, right? Yes, like a child star, but he's been just doing Vegas shows. Penn and Teller had a Vegas residency. I think they still do, but I'm not 100% sure. So it's like, I'm not saying it's bad. Like you said, it's a smart business move, certainly, and it's certainly profitable, right? But Jeselnik, he's got this same cadence now. So while I liked him, and I'll watch, like, I watched his new special, Bones and All, the most recent Netflix special he had. It was okay. But honestly, William, if you saw his other two Netflix specials, Fire in the Maternity Ward and
I saw all three of them.
Thoughts and Prayers. By the time you get to the third one, like the newest one, how different was it than the first two? Honestly.
I'm going to defend them because Big John is right. It wasn't that they were less funny. It's like, okay, it's just, you figure out. It's not that he's predictable. It's the same humor, you know. So Jeselnik is somebody once a year I'm cracking up at the show. But when you watch multiple shows, you do get the predictability. I don't predict the jokes, but you know how it's gonna end. You're like, okay, where's he gonna go with this one? You know, and some of them you can't predict. You know, it's like the dementia one. You know,
I did that one. Like I knew that joke. I had figured out three words into it, right? Because you knew where it was going.
But you eventually figure the next ones out, because I'm in that industry, or used to be, and I did. But that was the first special I saw. He the one in San Francisco, whatever that one was, I liked him. And he, and what's so funny about Jeselnik, he's got his ugly, he's not ugly, he's not an ugly guy. He's got his hippie look with his last special. Then the one in San Francisco, he had a good looking hairdo, looking
nice. He was clean cut.
But he does the different, but Big John is right. Let's get into some of the things that Jeselnik. Jeselnik was making the rounds to promote that Netflix special that I saw.
Right.
And he talked about cancel culture. And he says, yeah, there is some cancel culture, but here's a quote. I think cancel culture is the cost of doing business. I think the term is overused at this point, and no one's actually being canceled. And that's bullshit, because a comedian went on there and says, look, I got canceled. My bank, I didn't have a bank anymore. This happened, that happened. You know, and my issue with Jeselnik saying that, yeah, you made it, and you have your stick, but you're not going against the man. You know, so I thought that was a bit arrogant, and it's not Jeselnik, it's people who can weather the storm who say shit like that. I'm like, right. I just want to slap him in the face, because you tell that to the comic who does get canceled, who's struggling, who's still living off of ramen and makes the wrong. In the day when we grew up, John, Richard Pryor, Stephen Wright was one of my favorites, but he never went political. The ones who did go political, it was always both sides. If there was a race joke, it was always whites, and it was always blacks. It was like, now if you do it like that, you're going to get canceled. So what about that starving comic? So I get aggravated when people like Jeselnik make say that, which is nothing but a damn lie. There are documented cases in every single industry of people getting canceled, including you and myself in the fantasy sports industry, which real quick to the audience, his best friend is Greg Rosenthal, who – I have met Greg once or twice because we grew up in the same sports era together.
We both have. We both know Greg. Yeah.
If he would remember me, but he probably remember the company I had, because my company was one of the best in the industry at the time. But that's who his best friend is. And I'll say it now, but we'll get into it in a bit. He does a podcast with Rosenthal. So, John, you were going to say something there.
Yeah, I think, look, cancel culture. Yeah, cancel culture is a weird thing, right? Like, I do agree, obviously, that there was this push to, quote, cancel people, particularly from the left. It also happened from the right, but more so from the left. And it only works if you allow it to work. And I think history has proven that, right? So people forget. When you talked about Pryor, when you talked about Carlin, those guys could get away with stuff if they had a rabbi or a godfather in the industry amongst the gatekeepers, right? So, for example, Richard Pryor got away with a lot of stuff. Like, have you watched, for people out there, go on YouTube, look at the Richard Pryor NBC series that he had for a season. Three shows into it, NBC tried to censor him, and Richard Pryor decided he was going to blow the whole thing up. So every show, he did stuff that he knew they were going to censor, that he knew they were going to cut out, but he didn't care anymore. But somebody at NBC loved Richard Pryor, and they kept him on the air. John,
why didn't he care? He had already made it by then.
Yes, you're right. Now, the other part of it is, like, also look, I also take a little bit of umbrage. You said now is the golden age of comedy. I disagree. The golden age of comedy was probably
John, I'm talking financially. Now is
well, right financially
now
even
golden age of comedy. No, right now there are more comics than ever before.
Look at the late 80s when you had the Kinnisons, the Andrew Dice Clays. There was a comedy club on every street corner in every major city.
But John, they weren't making the money they're making now.
I think if you adjusted for inflation, it would probably be around the same.
The Richard Pryors, the George Carlins, they could do the theaters. The average comic couldn't. They just – nobody knew about him except within that circuit.
Comedy
circuit for 20 years. Now they can expand their – no, financially. A comic – that was one of Jeselnik's issues. It's like, we are in a golden age, and yet we're not – perfecting our brand. We're not becoming better comics. We're getting lazy and doing the podcast.
Well, a lot of people have said you're right.
And I agree with him, but it's about becoming financially relevant. You took 20 years to become financially well off where you don't need it doing stand-up.
Yeah.
Tony Hinchcliffe?
Hinchcliffe, yeah. Hinchcliffe.
He didn't take 20 years, and he blew up with that podcast. God bless him. Dave Smith, who I don't think is funny at all, and I'm not saying that because I disagree with it politically. He's actually, I admire him in terms of how he handles his debates and all that. You can admire and learn from your enemy, but I disagree with him. But I tried listening to his comedy. And I'm like, dude, but I think the internet has helped him keep and grow his base. So what I'm trying to say is you may not find them funny, but if you agree with them politically, there's people who will continue to support them. So my point is they make money with angles of their
speech. Well, what's happening now that didn't happen back then, which I'll agree with you, is that comedians or anybody can own their own brand. They don't need anybody else, right? It helps if you have somebody else, but you can make your own brand. For example, you look at someone like Bobby Lee, right? He's the guy who used to be on Mad TV, right? People don't realize. Do you know that Bobby Lee has never done a comedy special of any kind?
No, that doesn't surprise me. But see, I'm not a comedic a connoisseur like you are, but Bobby Lee has hit my timeline on video, and I've seen his podcast. And you're right. Some certain people in my mind, I've never seen him, and I don't view Bobby Lee as a stand-up comic because I've never, ever seen one thing
of him doing stand-up. Yeah, no. He is a working stand-up comic. I agree with you, but I mean, that's his bread and butter. He got on Mad TV, right? He got a bit, but he's been an LA comic for the most part, right? So he was always near the TV. He got into Mad TV. He does movies every so often. His podcast, he was one of the first guys to say, I'm dedicating myself to this new art form of podcasting.
Who's and the redhead?
Huh?
Who's his redhead sidekick?
Oh, that's Andrew Santino.
Okay. For the audience, his podcast is about 4 million people, if I'm correct.
Yeah, it's called Bad Friends. The podcast is Bad Friends. And he also
gets serious guests on there. He gets AAA guests on there.
Yes, and they also – move on, though. Yeah.
Your final points on the cancel culture.
The cancel culture, and the reason I was bringing up all these podcasts and stuff is comedians can now own their brand. So to the extent that you can't be canceled if you don't allow yourself to be canceled – look at Louis C.K., for example. He lost his FX deal. He lost his movie deals, but he's still one of the biggest comedians in the world when he decides to go out and tour because he did not give in to the cancel culture.
I got to push back. He was nobody. He had to go through his silence, meaning let's forget about him. And then he was slowly welcomed. So, no, that's a bad example.
No. What I'm saying is
– He was so rich at that point, he could afford to lay low. And it's slowly – because you know who else is doing that? And not in the comedic world? Who's the guy that's been accused of likes a young boy?
Oh, Kevin Spacey.
Yes. Last year he came out. With great applause. It's like they do their time, they hide away.
But the difference is a Kevin Spacey can only come back if the gatekeepers allow him to come back. Because the medium that he's in cannot be self-owned. For example, he needs a producer to put him in a movie. He needs a studio to put him in a TV series. He needs something like that. Louis C.K. owns all his material. He owns his comedy. He owns his distribution networks. He's got his own website. He's, you know, whatever. Podcast.
Those are pipers. He hasn't done a big special yet. He hasn't been back in the movie.
Louis.
He hasn't done TV on FX. He hasn't returned to those formats.
He hasn't returned to those formats, but he doesn't need them. That's the point.
Why? You're missing my point. Why doesn't he need them? Because he's so rich now. Now, stop for one second. Louis C.K. He's actually a bad example because I was going to say, take a young unknown comedian. Oh, and he gets caught masturbating. You know, so he was a legit cancel. He needed to go off stage for a while. I'm talking about the ones who make the off-color joke and the world condemns him. I'm talking about the young comedian who's coming up, makes the off-color joke.
But those young comedians don't get canceled for the most part because they're not well-known enough to get canceled. There's no point in canceling a nobody, William.
Matt Rife is a good example. They try to cancel him, but he did. Actually, he is your example instead of CK.
Sure, fair enough.
He built his own brand. He sat there and said, nobody was helping me. So I took advantage of the internet. And yeah, that's how. So then once he got known on the internet, he started selling out shows. And
well, Shane Gillis. Shane Gillis is another one. Shane Gillis is probably an even better example.
Yeah,
of that.
You're right. He's I saw his show on Netflix. He has a show on Netflix, people.
Tires.
And I saw one episode and I'm like, click, you know, but I'll support him. Why? Because I'm a conservative. I'm like, hey, let's support the people who say, as Big John says, and Jeselnik believes, fuck the try to cancel me. Because they're right. They are right. Big John and Jeselnik are right. But that's the outlier person. That takes a different makeup of a human being to go, fuck you. Even Louis C.K. did not say fuck you. Louis C.K. went into hiding. But then again, he's a different case because he was caught beating off. And literally, people, if you're not aware of it, he would drop his trousers, start masturbating in front of women because I'm Louis C.K.
It wasn't quite like that.
I apologize. Hey, can I drop my shorts?
Yeah, he asked. Yeah, look,
hold on. And in the horror, when they're not saying anything, oh, that must mean it's okay, and pull his cock out.
Yeah. And thank you, by the way, because you're going to get us demonetized for this video, so that's okay. But no, seriously. But all the whole. Yeah. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. Louis C.K. is different because when they tried to cancel him over that, there was actually a distinction, and a lot of other comedians came to his defense. Like Chappelle came to his defense, Rogan came to his defense, saying, look, the guy's got a weird sexual kink. But none of these women claimed that he held it over them. None of these women said they were trapped.
Let me do that to Joe Rogan's wife or Dave Chappelle's wife. That's the problem. There are certain things that are indefensible, and they're defending them because they take the free expression or choice or whatever.
No, listen.
There's common decency, and you don't, John, I'm a sailor. I have seen some of the worst. There's stuff I haven't seen that, hey, we're all going to go here. I'm like, I'm not going to go watch that shit. And it's your classic tropes that you see in movies and stuff. I've seen the worst of the worst, and men, with such as what you're doing right now, they'll rationalize it away.
I'm not rationalizing it away. I'm saying it's different than someone like, what's his face? Like Brian Williams, who had the door with the button that would trap the interns in his office.
That was Matt Lauer.
I'm sorry. Not Brian Williams. Apologies. Thank you for correcting me. That was the other NBC news host. But that's a different story. He's obviously coercing people into doing what he wants, right? Like in the CK, there's the slight delineation that none of these people had ever accused them of locking the door and not letting them out.
See, that's where you're not being truthful. CK was a man of power. He had connections who could make these comics. See, there's a power dynamic. There's always, you know, we experienced it at our jobs. When I had my company KFL and we were on top of the world, I saw that power dynamic. I saw how people would kiss my butt. I saw even advertisers who my website was ranked in the top 2,000 in the world at one point. Our traffic was off the charts. I was just telling Big John, in the old days, we were replacing our server. There were a couple of times. It was within a few weeks of getting the newest, most upgraded one because we were blowing through traffic so much. There is a power dynamic, and that's why the Louis C.K. is a terrible example. That's why Matt Rife is a better one. They tried to cancel him. The left did, you know, because he does. Matt Rife does it so well, though. He'll do the anti-gay joke, the anti-black joke, the anti-white joke. And he's like our old school comedians that we love. Everybody's laughing along, which is what a comic is supposed to do.
The point is
they tried to cancel him, but the power of the brand he built, it was a false cancellation. That's a cancellation that I'm talking about. Louis C.K. is, we're never going to come to agreement because you don't whip out your cock in front of a woman when she doesn't say it's okay. It's that simple, you know?
But they did say it's okay. That's the point.
No. See, you're doing selective memory. I remember that when it happened, because when it came to anything getting canceled, I was in on it, and I just go, that's my job. Remember when I was doing the roundup and all that? I go deep. There were women who said to say, I didn't know what to say, I didn't know what to do. This is Louis C.K. What do I do? This guy, if and there were people who say, well, you can't really say anything about it. and they would insinuate Louis has a we can make or break you.
Well,
so no, you're completely wrong on that.
I don't think I am. But the point is, in the sense that he did not yield to it, in the sense that someone like Daniel Tosh didn't yield to it, in the sense that someone like Shane Gillis didn't yield to it, or Matt Rife, or any of these people, in that, to that extent, yes, that's what you have to do. You have to not yield. Unless, of course, you do value whatever it is they're offering you. Right? Because the cancellation only works if you're afraid of losing what they're giving you, of losing what you have. Right? Otherwise, it won't work.
You know, you're right. I'm just saying Louis C.K. is not the example. That's not the hill you want to die on.
All right. I think we've argued enough about that, whether Louis C.K. But the premise of it, I agree with him. Like, if you don't allow yourself to be canceled, then you won't be canceled. It's easier to take that stance now, because now the means of distribution are more in the hands of the artists, right? So that's why it's harder to get canceled if you don't allow yourself to be canceled, if you're a comedian, John's especially.
Right. John's right. But people, it depends where you're at in life. When I've cost myself a lot in life, and the worst times I've been canceled have been, though, when I actually had something to fall back on. Before then, I was always wary, but I stuck to my guns because of mama, you know. Real quick, John, before we move on, I asked John to come on here, and I'm picking on him. Yes, there were women who chose not to speak out against Louis C.K. due to fear. In the comedy community, was an open secret that Louis C.K. had engaged in inappropriate behavior, but many women were afraid to come forward because of his influential position in the industry. Those who did speak up often faced marginalization, blackballing, or other forms of retaliation. That's what I remember out of it. Because I was like you. Well, no, I mean, they could have said no to that. Then when you start digging into it, that's when I quickly realized, oh, I didn't realize how big Louis C.K. had become. How big his FX show was.
I think the timing is not, again, we could come off of this if you want. But what was important is, like, I heard it was the Me Too, but I also remember Sarah Silverman saying, like, yeah, he did the same thing to me. And I told him to F off. And what she always said was that he wasn't somebody who would slam the door shut and said, you got to do this. He goes, it was weird. It was awkward as all hell. Like, I'm sure it would be for anybody in that position. If he said, hey, can I just do this in front of you? Cause it turns me on or whatever. Like, supposedly she said, if women said, no, I don't want to do that, he would say, okay, sorry. You know, and he would, you know,
no, John, you're right. You're right. But there are consequences, and if you don't know what the consequences are and you've struggled your whole life, especially as a woman. See, this is one of the few times I look at it like, yeah, we are equal technically, but there is a power issue here. And because, I was at a fast food restaurant growing up, and the woman held the power over me. You know, now, I didn't mind as a man sleeping with her. I was a 20-year-old kid. It's all I wanted to do. But I realized the opposite. Oh, man, I'm going to get a great schedule. What if I had not? You know, by shifts and all that. So there is a power dynamics. But John's right. But what John is failing to see is Sarah Silverman is an outlier. That's not the norm. It's like a wife beater or the wife. You know, dude, why don't you just leave him? You know, they're scared. The guy's going to track him down. That's why they go.
No, but in those, wife beating is not a good analogy because that's just violence.
It is a good analogy.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. And here's why. It's a power dynamic. It's control over the woman. It's not the beating that's the issue. It's the power the person holds that's perceived by the woman. Power is not just getting beat. Power is the hold you exert. That's why you see a lot of emotional abuse. So that she was, it's like the Menendez brothers, whether we agree or not, because I think they should stay in jail. But there's a legitimate, I think they should get a new trial based off the second trial. But they were emotionally abused. Now, I thought they killed the parents for money and all that. But they were emotionally abused. He held that power over them, and it's a different dynamics. But let's move on, Big John. It's my show.
I was going to say we should move on because you're starting to sound very much like a liberal right now.
No, it's called being a humanitarian in that issue. All right, groupthink. He positions himself as an outsider to groupthink. You mentioned Jim Norton. You mentioned Bobby Kelly, but there's Jim Norton, Colin Quinn, Keith Robinson. He's been influenced by them, but he views himself as a loner. So he's not into the group think. He's criticized Joe Rogan's podcast as his circle of friends. And my take is, hey, that's fair. I'm not a Joe Rogan fan. I see what Jeselnik is saying. Yeah, it's all his hangers on and all that. But hey, that's their shtick. That's their human nature. It's human nature to do that. It's like, if you don't like it, that's fine. But why criticize it when people think you're an asshole?
Well, also, the undertones of what you just said is, look at the people he just said he looks at as influences or positive role models. Jim Norton, Bobby Kelly, Keith Robinson. These are New York comics. Now look at the people he doesn't like. Joe Rogan, Burt Kreischer, Tom Segura.
The LA comics.
All the LA comics. What's the essential difference between the two? The LA comics are all trying to get a sitcom. I don't care what they do on. They're all trying to get a sitcom. New York comics, their rite of passage is sitting at a table in the cellar and destroying each other every night. Every night, those New York comics are actively trying to destroy the very soul of their brother comics. Okay? It's a completely different vibe. So that's why you have all these talented comics in New York that don't make it as sitcom stars or movie stars. Like, here's a good, the only one that I could think of that had that seamless sort of transition was Bill Burr. Bill Burr is a Boston comic, but he made his bones in New York with that crew, with the Bobby Kellys and the Jim Nortons and all those guys. And he was able to transition to LA and get his, you know, become like, you know, get movies and deals like that. So when you say Jeselnik, that's interesting to me that those are the comics he admires, whereas the ones he has issues with are it's a New York LA thing. And that's a different mindset.
Where's he live?
I actually don't know. He lives in LA. Yeah.
It's funny you say that. I'm going to go off topic here real quick because he's nothing like these hard hitting Richard Pryor or that, but Nate Bargatze. Bargatze, yeah. He lives in Tennessee and all that, but he made his bones in New York City. He talks about that and all that. It's just so funny because I view him as an outlier. Family friendly. He's like Bill Cosby's himself, meaning his shows.
He's a clean comic. He's like Brian Regan.
He made his bones in New York City.
Well, like, you know who his mentor was? One of his mentors was Patrice O'Neill, one of my favorite favorite comedian. Yeah. Yeah.
You see, you never get that. You never get.
Totally different styles. Totally different styles. Yeah.
Yes, well, let me ask you this, going off topic again. I view Nate Bargatze. I view Jeff Dunham and maybe one or two other comics. It's to me like you're outliers. You're not part of the norm I see in the comedic world, the cursing, the sex, all the shit. And they're funny. I'm not knocking those comics, but I kind of like take pride in the sense. They made it doing it their way, you know, and Jeselnik too. You know, I'll be honest. There's a lot of dick and big boobs and those type of jokes out there, but Jeselnik takes it to a different level. So him, Bargatze, Dunham, they've done their own shtick and they have massive venues, you know. So it just seems to me like there's room for all of these. So do you think he's picking a fight with Rogan just to try to get his name out there?
Well, there's a lot of people, comedians, I mean, that are starting to resent Joe Rogan's influence.
Okay, stop. So you're talking jealousy here.
I don't know. Some of it might be driven by jealousy. Some of it is also driven by what I always see is the young generation displacing the older one. Why Joe Rogan as a stand-up comedian, I don't particularly care for. I don't care for him. I think when he was younger, he had some good bits, especially with Brian Callen.
Still sucked. Joe Rogan was never funny. He's not funny. He made it. I mean, this is what I see from Joe Rogan. A non-funny comedian, paid his dues, part of that LA crowd, got lucky, and somebody said, hey, I have a great – one of his friends, a Phil Hartman connection – I'm not saying that Phil Hartman, but Phil Hartman was – he made that show so hilarious in many ways. But there were comedians on that show. I think that's how he got his in. Then he got Fear Factor. And his show that he just had last year was his first show in 6 years.
You mean his stand-up, not his show, his stand-up. Show that you're talking about was News Radio.
Right,
and he—that's where he became good friends with Phil Hartman. Now, Joe Rogan, no one can ever doubt his business acumen. I think he's always been focused on being successful. He's got the discipline of a martial artist because he was a Taekwondo champion when he was 17 or 18. So he understands the meaning of hard work. He got into the UFC initially, and, you know, him and Dana White, like, they're butt buddies. They're tight forever.
Has lived the American dream. See, I don't view Joe Rogan as a stand-up comic. I don't think he ever really was. I view Joe Rogan as a true entrepreneur. Maybe things fell in his lap, but as you said, he was smart enough to take advantage of them.
No, I think he made a lot of his own success. I don't fault him for that. But there is some resentment now among some people, some other comedians, saying, why does he get to decide who's funny? Why does he get to decide who's successful? Because one of the things Rogan does, and I think he does it from a good place, from what I could tell, is he tries to help other comedians. Like, he very rarely will you ever hear Rogan crap on another comedian. Very rarely will you hear him crap on another comedian.
Yeah, that's
the only one that he's crapped on was Carlos Mencia. And that's because Carlos Mencia is a joke thief. That's all there is to it. So, well, he's the first one who called him up, and talk about cancellation. Rogan lost a lot of his stand-up career because of what he did. So there's a lot of respect to be had to Rogan. But right now, when Rogan says this guy's funny, this guy's not funny, like, people will, for people out there, like, he anointed Gringo Poppy, and I can't remember his name right, Brendan Schaub. He anointed Brendan Schaub as being funny. The guy's an MMA fighter who's got CTE probably, and, like, he decided that he's funny. Like, comedians that have been working for 10 years who haven't gotten a special, Rogan, because of his connections to this guy, that guy gets a Showtime special. Well, right.
What you're trying to say, John, what you're trying to say is Rogan is this and it's beyond comedy. He is this generation's Oprah. And before Oprah,
yeah, he's a gatekeeper. He's become a gatekeeper.
I don't want to say gatekeeper. Not looking at it from that way. What I'm trying to say is, if you're on the Joe Rogan show, your book will sell a few thousand more copies that day. When you're on Oprah, your book will become a bestseller. So,
but it's,
he's got that. But you're talking to that. What you're saying is that's what he does in the comedy world. I've never looked at Joe Rogan as somebody who's going to tell me who's funny. I actually, for better or worse, Netflix does, because I'm like, okay, I just want an hour here. Oh, let me check this comic out.
No, I hear what you're saying. Netflix has become de facto a comedy kingmaker if you get a special on Netflix. There's no doubt. Same thing with HBO. It used to be HBO. It used to be Showtime. It's all the pay services, right? But – Rogan, as just an influencer, is starting to get exposed at how bad he is as a comic nowadays, how antiquated he thinks as a comic. Like, it's funny. Look at Shane Gillis. Shane Gillis and Rogan are tight now, right? Go back and look at the first appearance of Shane Gillis on Joe Rogan.
See, I don't see any of that. No, I am not arguing.
Yeah.
What I'm saying. This is why we brought Big John on.
But
then again, I don't look at Rogan that way. See, don't you think Rogan's kind of
transcended.
Kind of transcended the comedy world into just something bigger?
I think
his friends are still in the comedy world.
Well, yes and no. So I think there is a lot to be said that Rogan shouldn't be considered a comedian anymore. He's just a podcaster. He created his own genre of entertainment. And look, I wish we could all do that, right? Like, we tried to do that in the fantasy industry. We tried to do it in sports talk. He did it for podcasting. But he's also got his view of how things should operate. Like, if a young comic goes on his podcast, he's got the same advice for all of them. Quit working for anybody else. Start your own podcast. Never read comments. It's like the same five pieces of advice. But what Rogan doesn't understand, either because of luck or his hard work or the combination of both, he is a very unique individual in the way his career played out. The way his career played out will not work for the overwhelming majority of stand-up comics who are coming up the ranks right now. They still have to hit the road. They still have to go to these little, like, watering hole nothing areas in the middle of the country, like Kansas in 10-degree weather.
In fact,
I'm saying that's part of the maturation. I agree with you.
In fact, but Rogan bought a comedy club, I think, in Austin.
It's one of the biggest ones, the Mothership. And supposedly it is so good that everybody's moving to Austin, which means It literally means Rogan has now become, again, even more of a kingmaker when it comes to stand-up comedy. And you look at all the people in his orbit that he's anointed, Tom Segura, Joey Diaz, Bert Kreischer is one of the unfunniest comedians I've ever seen in my life.
Was he one of the one that was a duo at the Tom Brady roast? It was just
yes, terrible. He's the guy, the machine. Terrible. He always takes off his shirt, right? I don't like him. A lot of people like him. He sells out theaters. He sells out stadiums in some cases. He is, I think, one of the top three comedians in the world in terms of earned money. Ticket sales. But I don't think he's that funny. Other guy that's very funny is that Russell Peters. I mean, he's okay. I don't personally find him, and he's probably the top global comedian in terms of
sales. Okay, before we close this out, though, I want to run a few names. Tom Papa, funny or not?
Tom Papa's funny, yeah.
I've heard him for the first time last night. I saw his podcast when I was
researching. Oh, he's been around. He's been around forever. Yeah. Tom Papa.
I found his jokes chuckling. I found his jokes like, man, you're going to be a hit at a party. How the hell you're filling out this theater? I don't know.
Yeah, but they're Seinfeld jokes. They're Seinfeld jokes. That's why he's tight with Seinfeld. You know, that's why he was in the Seinfeld Unfrosted movie. He's got that Seinfeld observational Midwestern doesn't offend anybody type of humor, okay, right?
So, okay. Sebastian, his last name,
Maniscalco. Maniscalco.
What are your thoughts on him?
You know, I like him in his new HBO series, Bookie, about a illegal bookmaker. I think he's very good in that. Yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought his last show sucked. Stay away from politics. Stay away from your divorce. I'm not saying either one, but he kind of went a little bit conservative politics. I'm like, I just want to laugh. Don't try to mix humor with what's pissing you off because it never works. Next guy, the guy he had his own TV show back in the early 2000s, Rodney something from the Midwest. You know what I'm talking about?
One of those blue collar guys?
Yeah, we'll go back to him. Okay, Jeff Dunham. He's such an outlier being a ventriloquist who's made it big.
He's a hack.
He's hilarious.
A hack. I think he's a hack.
What do you mean by hack?
I think for the most part, all prop comics are hacks. So that means ventriloquist, Carrot Top, like very few prop comics, I think, are funny genuinely on their own. Like Gallagher was never funny.
Yeah, both I never found Gallagher in the water.
Both of the Gallagher brothers weren't funny. Yeah. So is Dunham the best of the ventriloquists? Okay, so sure, maybe. Dunham, I don't know.
One of the few that Dunham, I laugh out loud still.
Yeah, it's also a preference.
Maniscalco,
Sebastian Maniscalco.
His early shows, I cracked up. His last couple of shows,
I'm not as familiar with his stand-up. I've only caught two or three of them.
Oh, no. His stand-up's pretty funny, especially with technology and his facial manners. And Bobby Lee, what are your thoughts on him?
Bobby Lee's a weird one. I think he's one of those comedians where I think I like his podcasts more than I like his stand-up.
Jim Gaffigan.
I put him in the same as Tom Papa.
Yeah, I don't find him funny at all.
He's one of these Midwestern, like, you know who the king of clean comedy is? Brian Regan. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Brian Regan never curses.
Is it? No, I'm thinking somebody else. Bill Burr.
He's got sort of like a cropped, like a Marine haircut. He's in his 50s, 60s now. Never curses. Does hilarious guy. I view Gaffigan, Papa, Seinfeld. They're all in that same non-offensive, doesn't curse, Midwestern. You could take your grandmother to them.
Lightning round. Oh, gotcha. We're at 109, and I want to get to the audience here. Dave Chappelle.
One of the best of all time.
Bill Burr.
Hilarious.
Ricky Gervais.
Getting better as a stand-up. As a comedian, as an actor and a writer, genius. As a stand-up, he's getting better.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat. His last two I thought were hilarious, but, he grew on me. Trevor Noah.
Horrible.
I agree. John Mulaney.
Awesome. Love John Mulaney.
See, everybody tells me that, but I must have caught a weak show. I saw him on Netflix, and it was terrible. I was like, this
Catch
looks horrendous.
his specials before he got sober. I know it's horrible to say.
Yes, it was after. In fact,
Yeah, no.
that was what his whole show was about, was
Yeah.
him going to the clinic trying to get sober. I'm like, again, I don't care. Give me something
Was
funny,
it
you know?
Sweet Baby J?
I can't remember.
I
I
think it
mean,
was
there were
Sweet Baby. That's his
I
latest
laughed at
one.
it.
Yeah, it's his latest one. Go watch the ones before he got sober. Hilarious.
Okay. Amy Schumer.
She was only funny for a very brief period, and that's when she was associated with Opie and Anthony.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I didn't know she was associated, but her early work is when I would laugh at her. Kevin Hart.
Old Kevin Hart was amazing. Overall, he's still good.
Chris Rock.
One of the goats.
Yeah, I can't argue that. Ellen, and you know what? It's funny because when we say the GOAT, one of the greatest, I don't think of the now because I'm like, you're not so funny now because life hits you, you know, the reality. But before, when you're younger, you were like,
Yeah,
wow.
hilarious. Yeah.
All right, here's one because I don't know if she's done a stand-up comic routine in 20 years. Ellen DeGeneres.
Oh, back in the day, she was funny, especially for a female comedian. Yeah, she was funny. And this is before she came out of the closet. I'm talking like maybe early 80s. She was funny.
I discovered her with her first show and I applauded it. That's how you bring gay acceptance and all that was how her first show did it. You don't shove it in people's face. You kind of show it in a way where I did not realize that. I just learned something.
Yeah.
And she never strayed from that. She never pushed her gay until the last few years. But then we found out how vile a person she was, or the reports. Ali Wong.
I actually loved Ali Wong. Her latest special, not as strong as her earlier specials, but Baby Cobra was hilarious.
Yeah, I only talked 10 minutes and I was switching to her last one. You know, it's like, no, lady, nobody wants to sleep with you still. Because she's divorced now, I guess. Sarah Silverman.
I liked her, but I don't know that I would consider her a stand-up. I like more of her sitcom-y shows, like her Comedy Central shows were good and her specials were good, but I don't know if they were strictly stand-up. It's a weird format. But yeah, I enjoyed her back in the day.
Nate Bargatze.
He's good. He's good.
Patton Oswalt. I could only deal a few minutes of his show, but
He's a weird one. I with him, I have to divorce the politics of the man's real life versus his stand-up. Average. I'd put him at average.
yeah, it's you know, and to defend these losers when they get into the when they deviate from I like you for comedy. I don't give a rat's ass what you think politically. They don't realize you are alienating yourself. Just stay away from it. And yeah, when I see Patton Oswalt, you know, I it's click, change the channel. Here's a new one who I think I saw her. I think it was Tom Brady's Rose, Eliza Schlesinger.
Eliza Schlesinger and the
She's a
one,
tall
but
one,
she,
kind of good
but
looking little
no,
kid.
no, the one on Tom Brady's Rose was Nikki Glaser.
Ah, that's the one. That's the one.
Right. Nikki Glaser's been around forever. Hilarious. Even her latest special on HBO, Someday You're Gonna Die is the name of it.
That
Very
just came
good.
out, I think. Just
Yeah,
came
it
out.
was a couple months ago. It was right after the Brady Rose. That's why she was doing it. And I think she just hosted the Golden Globes, or she's gonna host the Globes
Oh,
or
yeah, that
whatever.
was last night, or that
Yeah.
was yesterday, or tonight, something
Yeah,
like that.
she was always funny, very raunchy, especially for a female, very raunchy, but hilarious. And she seems to have found a niche as the female roaster right now.
Well,
So
that's what I'm
she's,
saying.
yeah.
I know, I see her when I think of her. And you said raunchy. My first thing is that's because I see her in a roast. It's like if you, for you people out there, watch Comedy Central is truly hit and miss with the funniness. But their roasts were they took the Dean Martin roast and did them well, did them justice. I mean, completely different, but the heart and soul of what a roast is supposed to be. I
Right.
just saw 10 minutes of the Trump one, and they ate him up alive in that one. So yeah, a couple more here. Hasan Minhaj.
Horrible.
Yeah, I thought so too. Wanda Sykes.
Horrible.
Okay. Oh,
Well,
real quick.
let me take it back. Let me take it back. She's horrible now. When she was still straight, she was funny.
Before I forget, Ray Romano.
You know, I don't want to answer that because I never really saw his stand-up. I learned about Ray Romano from his sitcom. So it's kind of hard to divorce it. Like, I think he's hilarious in his sitcom, but I really haven't caught his stand-up.
There's a stand-up he does in New York where he got his start, his first stand-up in like 20-some-odd years. He went back to the first place. I chuckled, but then again, he's in a different point in his life. Yeah. Okay, we're going to do really some fast lightning here, old school, going back from the 40s to now. 10 classic comedians. Maybe not all of them are stand-up, but your quick thoughts. George Carlin.
One of the GOATs.
Richard Pryor.
The GOAT.
Joan Rivers.
Oh, groundbreaking.
Robin groundbreaking. Williams.
Loved him as a child. When I was a kid, I loved Robin Williams. The older I got, I was disenfranchised by his reputation as a joke thief. And that stream of consciousness wore on you after a while. But as a child, I loved him. I thought he was awesome.
I think what makes Robin Williams to be talked about in the elites is when he would go on a, not a rant in a bad way, just he was just nonstop, and it was a coke. You could tell.
It's called stream of consciousness. Just whatever came into his head, he could do for hours. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was brilliant. Yeah. Here's an old school one, because I never saw her stand up, but Lucille Ball.
I don't think she ever did stand up. She was just a comedic actress. You know, I Love Lucy. Yeah, I mean, who didn't love Lucille Ball and I Love Lucy? Yeah.
I didn't like her. I always felt bad for Ricky being a Latino. Why you treat your man like that? Ricky, why don't you slap you? No, I'm kidding. Bob Hope.
I always thought he was a hack.
Oh, he's one of the GOATs. He gave a lot of people their breaks, too.
No, I'm not saying he was a bad man, but I mean, if you're asking me strictly on comedy, I'm a hack.
Oh, he was funny. Those Christmas specials, the USO specials, they all did stand up.
I never really laughed out loud.
I never heard of this guy, Bill Hicks.
Bill Hicks. Oh, Bill Hicks, incredible original thinker as a comedian. One of the best. As a matter of fact, he's one of those comedians that other comedians say inspired them to become comedians. He's one of those guys.
He's one of those guys. Oh, that's why I never heard of him. He died at 32.
Yeah, and he was part of the Outlaws of Comedy coming out of Texas, the Outlaws of Comedy, which included Sam Kinison.
Okay, that's right. Okay, Sam Kinison.
Sam Kinison, as crazy as it sounds, died at the right time.
He died on top because he's one of the type of comedians, after a few more shows, you would have been like predicting.
He was already burning out. He was already burning out. Yeah. But so he died at the right time. Yeah. He died at the right time. He was funny. By the way, it wasn't just the screaming. Some of his routines about religion, about government, about just
he'd society. Attack them all. He would attack religion, would attack gays, would attack because I saw a thing they were trying to condemn him a couple years ago. And I'm like, you're saying all the gay jokes, you know, and the stuff that pisses gays off, but he did the same with religion. It was that he was one of the final vestiges of an era where everything was game, and that's what made him funny, I thought too. Phyllis Diller, Don Rickles.
Oh, love Don Rickles, yeah. Like, if you watched enough of him, it was repetitive, but it was the classic insult comic. Again, a lot of comedians now, the younger comedians, will still tell you that Rickles was one of their favorite.
Here's one I know you like. Mitch, he died. I know you
Hedberg?
Hedberg, yeah.
Believe it or not, I was not a Mitch Hedberg fan. You would think I would be, but something didn't click with him for me. So I appreciate the genius he was for other people, but not for me personally.
All right. And the final one, because every time you say something, a different name enters my mind. Two more names, and that's it. Stephen Wright, or was it Gary Wright? No, Gary Wright.
Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
He's in that Jeselnik Landisberg category.
I thought he was hilarious.
And yeah, he could be witty. Yeah.
I'll never forget the joke. I saw it as a kid, like, you know, when I left home and came back, my whole apartment had been robbed and they put everything back or something like that. Yeah. It's best would be lodging because that was my era of going to high school drinking and coming home.
Well, it was his other great joke, like I said, he could write funny jokes. I remember one joke that had me laughing. I don't know why, but he said, I read where most accidents occur within 5 miles of your home. So I moved 10 miles away.
Yes. Misdirection. He was great at that.
Yeah.
And the final one, who has dug himself a hole in the ground that he'll never get out of, Bill Cosby.
Look, comedically, you can't argue with Cosby. He was one of the great stand-up comedians ever. Also broke barriers, being a black stand-up in the 60s with Robert Culp on I Spy. But it's all been destroyed by what we know he's been doing all along, which is raping a lot of women. Like, here's the joke. Some comedian said this, and I forget who, I wish I could give him credit, but he said, picture this. The world's most trusted father, which was the title they gave him when the Cosby Show was running, was while he was the world's most trusted father figure, he was serially raping women. He was the world's greatest serial rapist. So, again, if you're asking me strictly comedy, one of the greats.
Oh, yeah, that's all I'm asking.
One of the greats.
To me, Bill Cosby's himself is, you could take your kids to it, and it was one of the biggest mm-hmm. comedy selling albums.
Himself. Yeah. It was called Himself.
Yeah. And I'll never forget the line. Boy, that's just an old man trying to get to heaven. Because that's how I look at my parents now. Y'all just people trying to get into heaven. That's how you treated us.
Well, my father, who was a funny man in life, but I never remember my father watching a stand-up comic ever or going to a comedy. Never. One day he saw me watching Bill Cosby himself because it was on HBO. It was one of the first HBO things they ran. And I remember I was watching and he came into my room while I was watching and he says, who's that? I said, oh, it's Bill Cosby. He's doing a comedy show. And he goes, oh, you mind if I watch it with you? I said, sure. And he sat down. He couldn't stop laughing. I've never seen my father laugh as hard. It was just funny. That whole dentist bit where he goes, and then you lean back and there's a rainbow of spit between you and the bowl. And they put your face in a toilet bowl. Like, his delivery, everything, genius, comedic genius, no doubt. He's the GOAT.
People didn't understand why I was glad he got off. They couldn't understand that I was happy that they caught the abuse of the district attorney and how they railroaded him. But they were like, I can separate. He was guilty. But you see what happens when you do everything you can to make a name for himself and you disregard the law and you go overboard. And that's what happened. The Supreme Court was like, no, you can't. You do this, this, and this, and this, and this. And that's illegal. Bill Cosby is off. So he owes his freedom today to an overzealous prosecutor who wanted to make a name for himself. If he had not been overzealous and had just followed the law, slam dunk, he would have still gotten all his accolades, but instead went overboard.
I think it's just amazing that in the comedy circuit, everyone knew that he was raping these women. Everyone knew, like comedians to themselves. Keith Robinson, no, not Keith, was it Keith Robinson? Or no, it was Hannibal Buress. Hannibal Buress was the one who brought it to public attention. Right. Like during his stand-up, he said, oh, you're coming up to my room? Yeah. He writes, I think, for Wanda Sykes, I think. Anyway, but my point is that guy is the one who, during one of his stand-ups, said, oh, you guys are acting like I'm going to invite you up to my hotel room and rape you like Cosby. You know, and the whole crowd went, ooh, and he was, wait.
Oh, you guys- who else? The casting guy in Hollywood that's in jail up in your neck of the woods.
Oh, Weinstein. Weinstein.
Well, it's kind of like in my industry, I know, and I'll never say their names because I felt sad for them. The stories I heard about the female reporters. These female reporters, yes, America, they're sleeping with the athletes to get stories, to go ahead. I heard so many stories, and I was like, not that. I almost said the name. Not that. No, not.
I think I know who you're talking about, and I've heard those stories too. Yeah.
It was sad. But anyway, Big John.
Please don't say any of their names so I don't have to edit it out later.
I know. Except for Bill Cosby. Bill. Guys, to the audience, I apologize. We're at almost at 90 minutes, but I just couldn't let Louis C.K. because I used to love him, to laugh at him. But I thought that was just a complete abuse of what he did. And you know what? If he has made amends, if he's changed, if he's gotten sexual counseling, hell, if he watches porn to masturbate to, so he doesn't do it in front of women, God bless him. You know, at least he's trying to get his stick taken care of. You know, but hey, Let's give the man some credit. Maybe he was packing because nobody said anything for years. Maybe they were laughing at it behind his back. But anyway, I apologize to the audience. Big John, you gave us some great takes. We just started out with Anthony Jeselnik and ended up with John's list there.
It's been a long and winding road, William, to this show.
And speaking of that, I'm going to stretch the show a couple more minutes. Then. Your final take on the actual topic at hand. What's your final take on Anthony Jeselnik in terms of what he's saying and his comedy? Two different takes.
I agree with him on his take about cancel culture. Just don't let yourself be canceled. If you're in a position to be canceled, then keep your mouth shut. As a comedian, I put him at somewhere in that, like on a scale of 1 to 10, I put him at a 6, maybe.
My take is he's an idiot. He's made it, so it's easy to sit there and preach to the choir because you don't have to suffer the consequences. But I think he's brilliant in his own way, and he's one of the few comedians over the last 10 years that I just busted out laughing. And part of the reason I busted out laughing was because he was crossing the line, and I was laughing at the fact, finally, somebody who dares to cross the line. And with that, my friends, thank you for listening. Thank you. Thank Big John for coming on. We have him working hard here at Grumblings Media. And John, before I say goodnight, tell him a little bit about your libertarian podcast.
Sure, William. The folks out there can find me Thursday nights, live streaming, usually Thursday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern time. It's called Free for All, where I try to cover libertarian topics. Usually with some sort of interesting libertarian-leaning guests. And also, as they become available, Big Questions with Big John. That's a long-form interview, somewhere between 90 minutes to or so of me just interviewing a guest one-on-one and getting to know them a little bit better.
Who are you going to be working with on the podcast now, the Libertarian Podcast? And that's called Free for All, people.
Well, I'm Free for All. We're hoping to really continue. We had a great relationship with this guy during the election season, the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, Mike Termott. He's agreed to work with me, so we'll be seeing him not quite as a co-host, but as a featured contributor to Free for All. Looking forward to that in 2025, William, to have Mike join the Grumblings Media crew and give us some of his insights.
Outstanding. And to the audience, Jeselnik is right. Podcasting doesn't replace live comedy. However, no one has claimed that comedians are trying to do that. Podcasting is simply another medium for comedians. His criticism of others seems unnecessary. Why criticize others who are doing things their way unless you want to start a rivalry for business reasons? Comedy is subjective, as you saw tonight. I think Jeff Dunham is hilarious. Big John thinks he's a hack. We each have our own taste, and to give Jeselnik a plug, since we did talk about him, he has released multiple critically acclaimed specials, including Shakespeare 2010, Caligula 2013, Thoughts and Prayers 2015, Fire in the Maternity Ward 2019, and Bones and Awe 2024. His last two are well worth seeing, and I'm not sure if I saw Thoughts and a Prayer. So while his points about podcasting and live comedy are valid, his criticism of others may be more about creating controversy and rivalry. But despite all this, Jeselnik, in my eyes, is a must-watch comedian. His unique brand of dark humor, characterized by sharp wit and masterful misdirection, which Big John talked about, sets him apart in the comedy world. What doesn't necessarily set him apart as much as his misdirection is brilliant. And the way he does it, I believe, sets him apart from others. And that's what makes his performances worth the price of admission. And there you have it, my friends. I'm not going to go through all this shtick, but you can catch this show at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as YouTube, Apple, Spotify, e Pandora, under the profile handle Grumblings Media. I am William Del Pilar, and for Big John and myself, until next time, this is Red, White, and Rude, and I bid you adieu.